Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Harvard scholar Stephen Greenblatt about Lucretius, the ancient poet who created the modern world.
His poetry was like honey smeared around the lip of a cup that would make what might potentially be a disagreeable drink palatable.
The Times' Jacques Steinberg takes us inside the grueling world of Ironman competitions.
You're putting your face in the water and trying to alternate breathing. Meanwhile, people are bumping into you, elbowing you, and it rattles you, I'm sure.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Andre Osserman discusses his new book of travel essays.
The experience of traveling for me is disturbing. It's a form of malaise that I experience whenever I go anywhere.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. Stephen Greenblatt is that rare thing, a very distinguished American literary historian and scholar who's also a best-selling author. His new book is called The Swerve: How the World Became Modern. It's reviewed for us by Sarah Bakewell, who says Stephen Greenblatt combines hard-headed investigations of historical context with a profound feeling for the way writers somehow pull free from time. I'm delighted that Stephen Greenblatt's here to talk with us. Welcome.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, you have a fantastic story to tell. Let's start with Lucretius, this most amazing kind of philosopher, scientist, poet. Who was he?
We don't know very much about Lucretius, Sam. We know that he was born around 99 before the Common Era, that he died around 50 before the Common Era. That means that he was a contemporary of Julius Caesar or Cicero, an older contemporary of Virgil's. But otherwise, what we know is that he wrote one amazing poem that was the perfect conjunction, maybe the only perfect conjunction, between stupendous scientific intellect and poetic power.
Okay, so he writes this amazing poem that we know is The Nature of Things. So we set that aside. That poem was not known, or the text of it was not available for a very long time after it was written. What happened?
That's right, but it was known initially. It was known for several hundred years and admired. It's mentioned by the poet Ovid, for example. It was influential on Virgil and so forth. People knew it at the time. But starting in around the 4th century of the Common Era, it goes underground. It goes underground for lots of different reasons. Lots of things went underground. The Roman Empire began to fall apart. People stopped copying books. The libraries were shut down. The education system fell apart. But this particular strain of philosophy, the philosophy that Lucretius represented in his poem, the vision of the world that Lucretius represented in his poem, was particularly unwelcome to Christians above all, unwelcome to Jews and pagans as well, because effectively it denied religion. It denied the centrality of appeals to the gods.
And so this remarkable poem, which we'll talk about in a little more depth later, goes underground, as you say, great phrase. Then it's rediscovered. By whom?
It's rediscovered one day in January, 1417. We know that much.
So that's many, many hundreds of years.
A millennium. It is basically out of circulation for a millennium, which is an unbelievable thing to have happened. And it's not simply that this text is out of circulation. This is the only major surviving text of a huge school of philosophy that went back to ancient Greece, to Democritus, and to Epicurus. The whole school goes under. So that though Plato and Aristotle survive in parts all through the Middle Ages and a part of discussion were absorbed, as it were, into Christian culture in the Middle Ages, this one major school effectively goes missing. And then one day, January 1417, a book hunter and papal bureaucrat, a man named Poggio Bracciolini, finds the surviving copy of this amazing poem in a monastery in Germany, somewhere in Germany.
Does he know what he's found?
He knows the name, I think. He knows the name Lucretius because he and his fellow book hunters were very, very attentive to the surviving traces of the ancient world. And the name was mentioned, so they would have seen in a letter of Cicero's, they would have seen in a poem of Ovid's, mentions of someone called Lucretius.
So we're talking about a truly learned man in this period, someone who knew languages, surviving texts as well as work. He was a scriptor, a scribe.
He was a scribe. He was a secretary to a succession of popes. He worked for 50 years in the Vatican. And in his spare time, he was a passionate book hunter. And these people were truly like hunters in the sense that they tried to catch every conceivable tiny trace of something that might be out there that they could catch. And they recorded in their minds, in their memories, the names of hundreds of lost authors, because there are hundreds, even thousands of lost authors from the ancient world. So he probably recognized the name Lucretius, but he had never seen the poem before.
And so he reads it, and what does he make of it?
We don't know exactly what he makes of it. He makes of it that he's had a very good day. He also found Vitruvius, the great ancient work on architecture. He found Quintilian, the great ancient work on rhetoric. It's not clear that he sees that this is any different from the other big finds that he's made. He immediately writes to brag to his friends. They circulate the news among the circle of people who cared about these things in Italy. And he made had a copy made, because at that point the German monks were too wise to loan copies to visiting Italian humanists.
And just to clarify the obvious point, there's no printing press.
No printing press.
It all has to be copied by hand.
Everything is done by hand. And Poggio had a German scribe with him. He didn't take the time to do it himself. It's a very long poem, 7,400 lines long. But he had the scribe make a copy. He got the copy and sent it back to Italy to be copied again by a very learned friend. The copy that Poggio found in the monastery has vanished. Mm. The copy that the scribe made has vanished. But the copy that the friend made after Poggio sent it back to Florence, that's the basis basically for a whole succession of astonishing things that happened afterwards because of what was in that mysterious text that he found.
Now let's talk about the poem. It's one of the most remarkable writings in history. You quote the great American philosopher George Santayana, who said that the discovery, the insight Lucretius has into creation, he's writing about the very most cosmic subject, is perhaps the single most profound insight any human being ever had. What's this poem about,
it's Stephen Greenblatt? It's astonishing, isn't it? It's amazing that such a thing could be lost and found. And what's at the center of Lucretius's poem, and it's a very beautiful poem, something to which I hope we can return. What's at the center of the conception of Lucretius's poem is that the universe is made out of an infinite number of infinitesimally small objects that are in constant motion, and they're these innumerable, indestructible, eternal objects, and the void, emptiness, and nothing else. The Greeks called those things atoms. Lucretius uses a different term. He calls them the seeds of things.
Right. You said he didn't like technical jargon.
He didn't like technical jargon, and he was determined to give this a vernacular name. He didn't want to use a fancy Greek term, atoms, so he wanted to use a proper Roman term for a Roman audience. So he called it a Latin term for a Latin reading audience. So he called these things the seeds of things. Or the fundamental particles. And so he conceived of the universe as made up out of atoms and emptiness and nothing else. And then he drew from this the conclusion, everything that exists, if there's an infinite amount of time, could happen without any intelligent design, without anyone planning this, without a God who would make any of this. What would happen over an infinite amount of time is that the atoms would bang together, sometimes adhere to each other, sometimes come apart in a ceaseless experiment. His empirical vision of this, of course, there's no evidence for any of this. It's all wild, brilliant speculation. But he's someone who had looked in beams of sunlight and noticed that there were thousands, hundreds of thousands of tiny particles in the beams of sunlight. He knew those weren't atoms because they were too big. You could see them, little dust motes,
yeah,
constantly moving. And he thought, what if the universe is made that way out of innumerable tiny things in movement, and everything that exists eventually would come together, come apart, until the things that we have and see and are would, in the course of things, emerge and disappear, because nothing lasts forever.
So he has this astonishingly prescient theory of the universe and he puts it in a poem?
Well, his own explanation is probably as good as any. He said that his poetry was like honey smeared around the lip of a cup that would make what might potentially be a disagreeable drink, but that was good for you, like medicine, would make it palatable. And actually, the power of the poetry is probably one of the key things that carried it across the gap of many, many centuries.
So he's not just writing a poem. He's a great poet.
He is a truly great poet. It's very difficult in English to get a sense of the magnificence of his poem because there is only one magnificent, one marvelous, adequate English translation of part of the poem, only part of the poem, by the 17th century English poet John Dryden. There are many other poetic translations, some very good and some not so good, but he doesn't have a tremendous English language translator. And indeed, there was an effort, a serious effort for many centuries to keep the work out of translation, because even though the work was more or less tolerated when it came back in the early 15th century, it was tolerated because it was only the possession of a very small number of extremely learned men. But the idea of getting this work and its ideas out into the vulgar tongue was something that the authorities were very
It was a dangerous poem.
It was dangerous.
Because we're going to go – we go back to the period where Bracciolini discovers it or rediscovers it, and it has a theory of the universe that is totally at odds with all the teachings of the time, with the great heritage and legacy of the Judeo-Christian tradition. This is a heretic.
It's virtually a list, Sam, of inquisitors – asking points. Do you believe this? Do you believe that? That's it. We take you to the burn at the stake. It argues, for example, that everything wasn't created once and for all. It must have evolved very slowly over time. And that must mean that there were other creatures on the earth experimentally, as it were, other species before we existed. There will be other species after we cease to exist. Nothing is forever. These things are the result of something that he didn't call natural selection, but effectively natural selection. He says that if it's a living creature, it can find food for itself and it can reproduce, then that species, Lucretius thought, might continue for a period. And eventually, because the world will change, the environment will change, it will cease to be. But this was totally incompatible. Lucretius argues that the soul dies with the body, that there's no afterlife, no pushing of rocks up hills, no being rewarded in the Elysian fields. This is totally unacceptable. Every one of these propositions is unacceptable.
And what about, Stephen, the moment in which the nature of things begins to circulate? You say in the book, this is how the world became modern. So it does fall into more hands and other great minds begin to examine it. So is this when the period we think of as humanism emerges? Was Lucretius the key figure in this?
The humanists, of course, for the most part, were good Christians. And they would have been interested in a text like this because it was written in very, very beautiful classical Latin. They recognized the elegance of its poetry, but they would have regarded its ideas as the extremely odd ideas of a pagan thinker. So only a very, very small number of people in the early decades and even centuries after it returns were engaged in a serious way in its thought. It was too weird. It was like something coming down from another planet at that point. The greatest philosopher of the 15th century, the Italian Marsilio Ficino, the first person to get very, very close, fully intellectually to the work, was that remarkable Dominican heretic Giordano Bruno, who gets burned at the stake in the Campo di Fiori in Rome. So it's in 1600, almost two centuries after the work comes back. So intellectually, in terms of its ideas, you absolutely had to keep your distance, even if you got what was going on there. People who took in what was exciting about it and could speak about it, in effect, were artists like Botticelli, essayists, literary figures like Montaigne or Shakespeare. They can play with the ideas that are recirculating in the world because they can't be caught identifying with them directly and heretically without the thought police being called against them.
Thanks so much, Stephen.
Thanks, Sam.
That's Stephen Greenblatt, whose new bestseller, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern, is reviewed in the New York Times Book Review. Jacques Steinberg is a senior editor at The Times and one of its best-known correspondents, also the author of a best-selling book, The Gatekeepers. He has a new book now. It's called You Are an Iron Man, and it's about, well, we're going to find out what it's about. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you, Sam.
Okay, so we are talking about triathlons, but not your sort of normal triathlon.
No, we're talking about an Ironman triathlon, which is a 2.4-mile swim, which is basically like 175 lengths across your local pool, followed by a 112-mile bike ride, which is like biking from New York City past Philadelphia, and then topped off with a 26.2-mile marathon, and that all has to be done in 17 hours or less. They start at 7 in the morning. You've got to finish by the stroke of midnight.
So do you have to have compiled like really strong normal triathlon times even to compete in this thing?
One of the amazing things about this, and the book is about a half dozen weekend warriors who sort of engage in this quest, because most of the people who do these are weekend warriors. We tend to think of it as like just Hawaii, but now these races at the Ironman distance are all over the world. It's like a franchise, and there's a bunch in the U.S. You can just sign up. They don't even require a doctor's note. It's up to you to do sort of the tune-up races and the training that you think you need to be able to do this Herculean task.
Well, in fact, there was an excerpt of your book that ran over the weekend in the sports section. Fascinating and really riveting story of an individual competitor. We'll get to her. But in that story, you say, I mean, people die doing this.
People do die doing Ironman, and they die doing triathlons of much lesser distance. We had two deaths in New York City this past summer after the New York City triathlon, which is about one-third the distance of the Ironman, at least in terms of the swim. And the deaths are disproportionately in the open water swim as opposed to the rest of the race.
Right. That's the first part of the race. And you describe actually one competitor in particular and just how scary it is to do this. Why? I mean, these are very powerful athletes. Why does the swimming part freak them out?
You know, you're in the water. There are close to 2,500 people around you. So that's 2,500 pairs of arms and legs splashing around you. In this case, the case of the Ironman in the book, it's Ironman, Arizona in Tempe Town Lake. You're putting your face in the water and trying to alternate breathing. Meanwhile, people are bumping into you, pushing you down, not intentionally, elbowing you, and it rattles you, I'm sure.
And there's this fear that you could get dragged down. And nobody – there are people who are there to rescue you, but maybe they won't get to you.
There's, you know, there's kayaks everywhere, and the Ironman organizers will tell you that they are watching. And I'm confident they're watching, but it doesn't mean that you're not fearful. And again, the book is called You Are an Ironman. I've not undertaken this quest. I've just sort of watched and observed and talked to these folks. But the person who was featured in the New York Times excerpt is a 46-year-old mother of five from Sacramento. And just to add to her degree of difficulty – she has panic attacks in the water. And so in the book, you get to see if she completes this swim, which she has sort of assigned herself this challenge in the allotted 2 hours, 20 minutes, which is what the swim portion is.
So people of all ages, are there really young people who do this?
I've seen people as young as 18 do it and finish it. And I've seen, people in their late 70s. There was a gentleman who did Ironman Arizona the year before I followed it. Actually, in the year that I did it, it was just he had just had aortic valve surgery and also was recovering from prostate cancer surgery. He's a 76-year-old psychiatrist, of all things, from St. Louis, and he finished in the allotted 17 hours.
Are a lot of these people, Jack, former athletes, people who, competed at a high level in one sport or another, and this is how they stay in shape, this is what they do? Or are there people, like marathoners, for instance, who are kind of athletes in middle age or older who just gravitate toward this?
I think it's all of the above. And one of the most fascinating things in terms of reporting the book were the various reasons people had for doing this. Some have been athletes all their lives and are looking for a new challenge. A marathon is not enough. I got to swim, 2.5 miles and bike to Philadelphia from New York before I can do my marathon. We live in a multitasking society, and this is, let's assign more tasks. But more often than not, I found it were people who did not consider themselves athletes as kids. This woman, Laura, whose swim is described in the Times, she was a chubby kid. She was a bookworm, never did anything athletically, and then suddenly started to blossom. And so the thing that's most fascinating to me, you and I spoke about the fact that these folks will tell you that they're a little crazy. How can you not be to take on something like this? But they're not as crazy as I thought they were going to be, in that all of them seem to be wanting to rewrite or expand the definitions of who they are, most often in middle age. And there's something very inspiring about seeing people at this stage of their lives pushing themselves beyond what anyone could think they could accomplish.
Now, are there people who are told by their physicians, you shouldn't do this?
I'm sure there are people who are told by their physicians they shouldn't do it. I mean, any reasonable person would go to their physician and ask, do you think I'm up for this? Who knows what a physician might say. But, you know, one of the characters in the book has a double lung transplant as a result of cystic fibrosis.
Unbelievable.
He's due for his transplant on September 11th in North Carolina. The planes are grounded. They can't get him his lungs. He's about to die. He makes a bucket list in the hospital. One of the things he says he wants to do is a triathlon, not an Ironman, but just a triathlon. 4 days later, he gets his lungs. 5 years later, he has finished the Ironman.
How did you find these people?
That person I found because his name is Scott Johnson, and I found him because his wife, Leanne, was undertaking the race. And I found them through a charity. A lot of these folks raise lots of money for charity. And I was inspired by Leanne because her feeling was, if Scott can do this after everything he had happen, what's my excuse?
So, Jack, when you say they're raising money for charities and they're kind of sponsored, they're swimming for or competing for these charities?
They set about, and there's a formal apparatus that enables you to, but you can raise money on your own. And I was brought into this whole world as an observer because there was somebody from my town who has raised over $1 million through his Ironman training and Ironman competing for a really obscure disease called Barth syndrome, which affects just a few hundred kids around the world, a debilitating disease. And the fact that, as a result of this work, yes, it's selfish. You're leaving your family for hours on end on the weekends to train for these things, to compete, and yet raising over $1 million for this disease that's not going to get any money otherwise. Again, I think you have to leaven the sense of craziness with that sort of, almost a noble pursuit.
Thanks a lot, Jack.
Thank you.
That was Jacques Steinberg, whose new book, You Are an Iron Man, is reviewed in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. So, Julie, that celebrated Jewish-American writer, Bob Dylan, did not win the Nobel Prize this year. Tell us who did.
He'll have to wait until next year. This year, Thomas Stranströmer, who is a Swedish poet and has a little bit of name recognition in the United States, but a lot more in his home country, where he's to the Swedes what Robert Frost is to the Americans.
He's an elderly man, right? He's been writing for a very long time.
He's 80 years old. His first book of poems, which was titled 17 Poems, was first published in Sweden when he was just 23 years old.
And has his work been translated into English?
It has. It's been very widely translated. In the United States, he's been published by Echo, the imprint of HarperCollins. He's been published by New Directions, by Grey Wolf Press in Minneapolis. So he's been published by a lot of highly respected independent presses and imprints of larger publishers. But he still has a pretty low profile in the U.S. I think that people who love him tend to kind of keep him a secret. And people who are really into reading poetry say that they feel that he should have won this prize 20 years ago and that they've just been waiting for it to finally happen.
Julie, as the Times' publishing reporter, one of your jobs, maybe it's one of the joys, is to learn about distinguished new authors or authors who are new to us. Have you had a chance to look at his poetry?
I have. I've tried to become an expert on Thomas Stranströmer's poetry in the last 6 hours since this prize was announced. What I've discovered is that what a lot of critics say about it and what they praise his poetry for is for its grace, its accessibility. He explores themes of isolation, identity, emotion. He is very elegant with his descriptions of long Swedish winters and the rhythm of the seasons and the palpable beauty of nature. Another thing that people commonly say is that in the many translations of his work, particularly the work in English, that there's a real accessibility to his poetry, that if you are reading his poetry in English, you don't need to decode it, that it's right there for you. And that's partly because he has had the very excellent translations of Robert Bly, who is really responsible for introducing his poetry to a lot of Americans.
And this is an interesting day for publishers, too, because if you're Echo Press or Grey Wolf, suddenly you have kind of a hot property. It may not be a Hunger Games, but still there's a lot of interest. Do we have any idea whether books are in print or they'll be rushing them into print so people can discover this important poet?
They are. My slightly unscientific study this morning showed that you really can't get a copy of his poetry right now. You can go on Amazon and maybe they'll ship you a copy in 7 to 9 days. There's certainly been a little bit of a run on his poetry, at least in the English translations. That's also not uncommon on a normal day when trying to get a copy of a collection of poetry. But Farrar, Straus, and Giroux told me this morning that they have recently acquired a small volume of his work, which will be released as soon as possible and definitely before Christmas. Echo said that a volume of poetry that they published in 2000 will be re-released, hopefully within days. They're rushing it out as quickly as they can.
And listeners can go on the New York Times website and also see a handful of Tranströmer's poetry as well.
They can. E-books are very difficult to find. I'm pretty sure they don't exist. One of the reasons for that is that poetry is often not released in digital form because the formatting is complex and difficult, and a lot of publishers just don't bother, especially because a lot of people, when they buy a book of poetry, they want to keep it on their shelf. They don't want to read it on their little black and white Kindle. So if you want the ebook edition, you might have trouble finding that.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Andre Aciman is one of America's most distinguished and admired essayists and novelists. His new book is called Alibis, Essays on Elsewhere. It's reviewed for us by Teju Cole, who calls it a beautiful new book, an extended aria on the sense of smell, and other topics as well. He says that Aciman is a spirited guide, sensitive to history, but alive to food, sunshine, art, and aimless wandering. The pleasure of reading him resides in the pleasure of his company. And I'm delighted that we now have the pleasure of Andre Aciman's company because he's here to talk with us. Welcome, Andre.
Nice to see you, Sam.
Okay, so this is only very loosely a travel book. It's really a book about memory and a word I want to ask you about in a moment, errancy. You go to Rome, you go to Barcelona, you stay in New York. What do you, as a traveler, as a dweller in different great cities, look for? What's your experience like?
I think that the thing I try to seize on is, what will my fantasies about this place tell me about this place? I never see a place for what it is. I see something else. And so it's that something else that I'm trying to hone in on.
And yet, some of the experiences you describe are the kinds most of us have. You're in Rome, you go to the Campo dei Fiori, and you buy some food for a panino, and you have a knife and cheese, and you cut it up, and you decide to hold on to the knife, and here's the moment that becomes very rich for you. Do you enter those moments with a hyper sense of consciousness, or are you just relaxing yourself into the environment?
I don't know. I don't think I ever relax myself in an environment. The experience of traveling for me is disturbing. It's a form of malaise that I experience whenever I go anywhere, especially if I go to a place to write about it. So the luster, the eloquence of the piece or of the experience comes after I've left the place and come back to New York, and I'm sitting in front of my computer and I'm saying to myself, what is it that I remember best? What is it that memory will provide for me? And I begin to write as a way of sort of excavating and digging deep, deep, deep in memory, in me, in what made me connect to this place, if I connected at all. Most of the time the connection is fortuitous. It may not last long. It may sort of peter away. We don't know.
Well, it won't be a surprise to our listeners that you've written very brilliantly on Proust, and these are Proustian ideas. But you also put them in contrast with others. For instance, your wife is a very different kind of traveler from you.
Oh, yes. My wife is an enthusiastic traveler. She's traveling with the wrong person because I am looking for places that remind me of something or that will eventually remind me of a place. I'm looking for a place where I might say to myself, can I live here? She's just going for the experience. I'm looking for a home. She's perfectly happy with hotels. She is a wanderer. She's happy to wander. She doesn't want to know what's coming up next. I cannot wait to retrieve something I can recollect.
Yes, you say you don't like monuments, for instance.
Oh, they bore me. I hate monuments. I hate museums. Anything that asks me to pay attention is basically asking me not to pay attention to myself. I'm not a selfish person, but I'm constantly aware of the fact that I'm misstepping everywhere I'm going, so I have to watch my step. I'm trying to find something that will mean something to me and just me. The irony is that once I've found something that means something to me, it turns out that if I formulate it well, it will mean something to everybody else.
Well, to mention a word that you use more than once in the book, errancy is a part of travel for you. What do you mean by that? Is it wandering somewhere you didn't mean to go, or is it your mind taking you someplace you didn't expect it to go?
It's both. I'm not an adventurous person that wants to find new things, but I find myself discovering new things, and I love new things, but I don't know how to go and find them, how to seek them. Sometimes by sheer coincidence or accident, I will find myself wandering. And that's errancy. And errancy provides fantastic opportunities that my conscious mind doesn't know how to look for. So it's the accident that will provide the meaning for things that I didn't even know I was looking for.
What's an example? One of the cities you describe, one of the most magnificent cities I've seen, I was there not long ago, is Barcelona. So how does Andre Asselman do Barcelona?
Okay. I arrive in Barcelona. I'm, of course, right away disappointed because the whole Gothic neighborhood is filled with something that looks like AstroTurf. They've demolished all their alleyways and they've put AstroTurf or something like some artificial plaques on the streets. So I'm walking on something that might as well be carpeted in New York. But I'm looking for something, and I've come looking for my Jewish identity. My ancestors left Spain 500 years ago, and so I'm back trying to retrieve something. And lo and behold, the experience of the Jews has been entirely eradicated. There is no sign that there were any Jews in Spain, at least not in Barcelona. There is a little town off Barcelona where I went, Girona, where there is significantly more information about Jews, but it's all sort of random and minute stuff. So the experience I have is I arrive in Barcelona, there is nothing Jewish there, nothing that is supposed to evoke the presence of my ancestors. That says something. In other words, if you want to perform a Shoah, you can and it will work. You eradicate an entire population. Well, that is the meaning of it for me. But I was also fascinated by the fact that there are so many conversos who have stayed in Spain, people who 500 years ago converted from Judaism to Christianity. And nowadays, it's very chic among the Spaniards and the Barcelonians and the people in Madrid to say, you know, we think we have a Jew in our ancestry. So it's become a bit of a joke. And I love that because it tells me that if you go deep down, you will find Judaism hidden, Judaism retrieved, Jews. And I compared this whole sort of series of tiers to how Schliemann discovered Troy. There's not one Troy, there are seven Troys, one built on top of the other. And that reminded me of that wonderful little bread that they do in Barcelona, where they'll put a piece of cheese on top of a fish, on top of tomato, on top of this and that, and you have everything is layered. And so Spain, for me, is an experience of being layered.
Andre, you also write about New York, about Manhattan.
Yes.
I was quite pleased to see this. I guess you and I are both were habitués of the great old movie theaters uptown on the Upper West Side, and you actually list all the ones that aren't there anymore. And you also describe Manhattan as kind of a place where great films were set, specific locations. Right. Describe that walk that you take.
Oh, it's a wonderful walk because you walk up Broadway, say you start around Lincoln Center. Of course, Lincoln Center means West Side Story. We know it doesn't take place there, but that's basically the center of all of New York culture since the 1950s, late 50s. And you walk up and, you know, you arrive at 67th Street. That's where the movie The Apartment was filmed. Well, you go and find 51 West 67th Street. It doesn't exist.
And that's the apartment that Jack Lemmon lives in and Shirley MacLaine.
Exactly. And that apartment has disappeared. The whole townhouse has disappeared. It's this new building. It's a modern building. So you say, okay, but I know the address. So the address means something, and it's something that you can sort of enclose in your brain, in your memory bank, and try to project it where it's no longer there. You keep going north. You arrive at, you know, there are all these movie houses that no longer exist. And then by the hundreds, you know that Humphrey Bogart lived there, Rachmaninoff lived there. There's Edgar Allan Poe Street, and then you keep going north. And for me, it's very important because that's where I saw all the Eric Rohmer movies that I've written about so many times. Eric Rohmer is a fantastic movie director, and he's all over New York. Now, he has no business being in New York, but I have brought him to New York in my mind, and I project him everywhere. And once I've projected him, I now can retrieve him from New York, which is, of course, nonsense. It's a fantasy, as Freud would say, but it's not to me.
Thanks so much, Andre.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Andre Aciman, whose new book, Alibis, Essays on Elsewhere, is reviewed in this week's Book Review. Jennifer Schussler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's super duper new on the super duper list this super duper week?
Well, we have a new book on top of the fiction bestseller list. I cannot tell you if it is super or duper. I have not read it. It is Lee Child's latest. It is called The Affair, and it gives us the backstory of his hero, Jack Reacher, and showed us how he got launched on his multi-book series of adventure. And at number two, another new book, Debbie May Comber's 1225 Christmas Tree Lane. Yes, it is almost Christmas already. And down at number 13, a new literary novel, Charles Frazier has his latest bestseller. It is called Nightwoods. And you remember Frazier was sort of the Cinderella story of the bestseller list of the late 90s. His Cold Mountain came out of nowhere, spent more than 60 weeks on the hardcover list, sold 3 million copies. He doesn't quite reach those numbers these days, but still doing pretty well.
Well, he also won the National Book Award that year, beating out Don DeLillo's Underworld.
Well, let me just ask you, which of those books got made into a movie?
Starring Renee Zellweger, right?
Isn't and that Jude right? Law.
Oh, man. So put your money on Frasier. What about nonfiction?
We also have another new book on top of that list. Bill O'Reilly, a great friend of the bestseller list, is back. His latest is called Killing Lincoln. It is written with Martin Dugard. And it is about the assassination of Lincoln. You guessed it. Interestingly, there are a lot of assassinated presidents on the list this week. Jackie Kennedy's Conversations with Arthur Schlesinger about JFK is at number two. It had been at number one for the past 2 weeks. And then Candace Millard's Destiny of the Republic about the assassination of James Garfield is climbing. She was at number seven last week. This week, she is at number five. Couple other interesting new books. Susan Orlean, author of the bestseller The Orchid Thief, is back with Rin Tin Tin. It is sort of a dual biography of the famous movie dog and his handler. And then down at number 14, Paul Hendrickson's Hemingway's Boat hits the list. You could call it a dual biography of Hemingway and his beloved fishing boat, the Pilar.
Jenny, Hemingway's been taking some hits these days. Woody Allen kind of made fun of him in Midnight in Paris. And then there's the very popular novel, Paris Wife, about Hadley, who was Ernest Hemingway's first and then jilted wife. How's he portrayed or depicted in Hendrickson's book?
The book, by all accounts, is actually quite sympathetic, you know, but it certainly doesn't gloss over the difficulties in Hemingway's life. It has a lot to say about his relationship with one of his sons, who was a very troubled guy. He was a cross-dresser. He eventually had a sex change operation. He also wrote a memoir of Hemingway that was quite loving. And Hendrickson sort of looks at this in the context of Hemingway's own gender confusions. And he also talks a lot about the kind of Hemingway's downward spiral in the last years of his life, his tendency towards sort of rage and irrationality, and of course, extreme alcoholism. And he sort of attributes it to some blunt force head injuries he had, you know, in various plane crashes and other accidents, you know, boxing, that kind of thing. So he doesn't really gloss things over. But interestingly, there's another notable Hemingway publication, not on the list, but something that real fans will be interested in. Finally, we are getting the first volume in Cambridge University Press's Complete Letters. You know, Hemingway was a prolific letter writer, but they've never all been gathered in one place. And in fact, a lot of them have been kind of kept under lock and key in his old house outside Havana in Cuba, and no one was really able to see them. And so finally, those letters are available. And they actually, the first volume actually includes what is the earliest recorded love letter he wrote to Hadley. It had been hidden away in Cuba. And it's actually quite beautiful, and it really shows why some of us, and especially why Hadley, fell in love with Hemingway in the first place. And it has some great lines. He writes to her and he says, "You can make me jealous and you can make me hurt most awfully, because my loving you is a chink in the armor of telling the world to go to hell, and you can thrust a sword into it any time." He also talks about why he didn't kiss her goodbye on a train platform, which apparently hurt her greatly. And he said, "I didn't want to kiss you goodbye. That was the trouble. I wanted to kiss you goodnight. And there's a lot of difference." That sounds like, you know, it's right out of The Sun Also Rises or something like that.
Isn't it pretty to think so?
Exactly.
Thank you, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.